Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones. No relation, by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Elaine Pagels, author of the new book Miracles and Wonder, The Historical Mystery of Jesus from Doubleday. Elaine is the Harrington Spear Payne Foundation Professor of Religion at Princeton University. Her previous books include Why Religion, A Personal Story, Revelations, Visions, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation, Beyond Belief, The Secret Gospel of Thomas, Adam, Eve, and the Serpent, Sex and Politics in Early Christianity, and The Gnostic Gospels, winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award and the National Book Award, and one of Modern Library's 100 Best Books of the 20th Century. Elaine was awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship in 1979, a MacArthur Fellowship in 1981, and the National Humanities Medal, which honors those who have deepened the nation's understanding of the human experience, in 2015. The New York Times Book Review writes of Miracles and Wonder, "The quest for Jesus has taken on many forms. Pagels takes the historical approach. The depth of spirituality she uncovers is profound." Please join us for our conversation with Elaine Pagels, which is already in progress. Elaine, thanks for joining us today, especially after a hectic day of travel. The new book's subtitle is The Historical Mystery of Jesus, and a big part of that mystery is his crucifixion and resurrection. So it's appropriate we're talking on Good Friday, a few days before Easter Sunday.
Yes, it's good to talk with you.
I want to first say I read Miracles and Wonder along with your previous book, Why Religion, A Personal Story, which came out in 2018, so about 7 years ago. That was somewhat of a memoir and provides a lot of context for the new book and a lot of context, I think, for our conversation. So I hope you don't mind if I go back and forth, maybe conflating the two at times, like the two books are kind of conflated in my mind.
Well, that's fine. I never thought I'd really publish that one because it was so personal. But then I thought, well, why not? It's just somebody's life, you know?
Oh, I found it added a lot of context to your own beliefs and your own writings and your own scholarly research.
It does. I mean, I think research that doesn't engage someone powerfully for certain whatever reasons are doesn't matter much.
So we'll start kind of early in your life. You grew up the daughter of a Stanford professor in what you call, quote, Palo Alto's suburban cocoon. I went to school there, so I know exactly what you're talking about. And though your father was raised Presbyterian, he was not religion, kind of adamantly against religion, I think.
Yes, he turned against it when he discovered Darwin. He just thought, okay, good. Now I can jettison all that nonsense and get to the real stuff, which is this is science.
Right. And you yourself, you soured early on the Methodist Church, which I think you attended in Palo Alto. You thought it replaced a passion for social justice with an emphasis on being nice. By nice, do you mean kind of obedient, don't make waves, don't cause trouble?
Well, it was just sort of, you know, the message was be a good person, be nice to people. I mean, that's not a bad message.
Oh, no.
It's that the power that had started Methodism was about reaching out to the issues in the world, about in society. And that made it very powerful initially. And you just didn't get that. I mean, here Jesus is, you know, has long blonde hair and blue eyes, and he's got children on his lap, and that's kind of the picture.
Right, and of course, historically, that's just not the case, which you know very well.
But he's not the Jesus of Mark's gospel.
No, and that's in the book. And you yourself, early on, you had a passion for the arts, dance, poetry, music, things you weren't finding in religion at the time, but all that changed in high school. You went with friends to see the evangelist Billy Graham, a very charismatic evangelist, in San Francisco at Candlestick Park.
Yes.
And that kind of changed things.
I didn't even know who he was. You know, I just thought, hey, we're going to San Francisco. And there were, you know, 18,000 people in the stadium there and 6,000 in the parking lot who couldn't get in. And the roads were packed for miles in every direction. It was a very big deal. And to my surprise, I found it very powerful and very compelling. And so I just went right into it. When the altar call came and you can have a whole new life and you can be born again and you can start all over, I just thought, that is for me. And I was very moved, and I went down and gave my heart to Jesus, and it was a powerful experience.
And giving your heart to Jesus, that's when you joined an evangelical church in Palo Alto, which appealed to you at first, up until the close high school friend Paul died in a car accident. Paul was Jewish. You told the church members, and you didn't get much sympathy.
No, I was so shocked. I mean, these are people I knew really well, and I said, you know, my friend just died, and they, was he born again? And when I said no, he was Jewish, they said, well, then he's in hell. And I was totally stopped, and I felt like I'd been punched in the stomach, and I couldn't speak, and I just walked out, never went back.
Again, an awful thing to say, whether they believe it or not. It's just not what you would say a grieving friend at the time.
But see, Billy Graham had talked about the love of God for human beings. That was the message. And then I thought, what are you talking about? Jesus was Jewish. But anyway, I couldn't even speak to them. So I just had to leave the whole thing, partly because, you know, Ken, at the beginning of the 20th century, a group of Protestant ministers, Presbyterians and Baptists and Congregationalists and, you know, all kinds of different denominations got together, and they said, we have to figure out what we all agree on. And what they agreed on is what they called the fundamentals, which are every word in the Bible is true. And that's what I was taught, and that's what that church was teaching. And that's what I think is a real problem with a lot of American Christianity, because it's taken very literally.
And it sets up a kind of an us versus them dichotomy. If you're not baptized, you're not going to heaven. You're going to hell. Now, when Paul died in that car crash, I was amazed to read another friend of yours was in the car but survived, Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead, and you knew him several years before he formed the band. You attended his wedding to his first wife, who was pregnant at the time, you write, and even lived with him for a summer in San Francisco.
That gives the wrong impression. He was dating my roommate.
Oh, I didn't mean to give that impression that
Yeah, that's just what it sounded like. It.
you just
But
in a big communal house. I'm
he
sorry.
and the band, he and the and others would show up because they would sort of have a place to hang out and be. So they often were there. And that was great because Jerry was a remarkable man.
Yeah, an odd coincidence. About 6 months ago, I'm a deadhead, so I don't know if you knew Robert Hunter there, but he was a friend of Jerry's, and he went on to become the chief lyricist for the
Oh,
Grateful Dead.
I know very well.
And he kept a journal, and it was published very recently, so about within the last year, called The Silver Snarling Trumpet.
I've read it.
He actually writes in there about the car crash that killed your friend Paul. And I'm just quoting from the book. Garcia and friend Alan survived the car crash with Paul Spiegel, he gives his name. The accident and the fact that he had survived and that Spiegel had not made Garcia, and here Hunter quotes Jerry Garcia, realize that I could never be sure where I'd be tomorrow or even if I'd be alive. That's why I'm living like I am now, doing what I want to do instead of working away at some job to establish the security for tomorrow I might never be around to see. Did Paul's tragic death affect you in a similar way? I mean, it must have been an incredible shock to be that young, and then all of a sudden your friend's gone.
It was a huge shock for all of us. I mean, we were young and full of energy and playful and, you know, sort of a crazy group of friends. And yes, he was very intense, and he was very gifted as a painter. And he was just so full of energy and life. And his death was a tremendous shock. And after that, we got to be very close. I mean, I just came from a conference about the Grateful Dead in New Orleans,
Oh, I didn't know that.
just this today. Yes, I've known Jerry for a while because he was hanging out and playing music, and he was an amazing musician already at the time.
And I know I know because I went to Stanford several years later, but you hung out at Kepler's Books, which is kind of an institution there in Palo Alto.
Yes, it was.
Now let's get to the new book, Miracles and Wonder. You write in the book's introduction, "Only now, after reflecting on the themes, texts, and enigmas of Christian tradition for decades, have I felt ready to engage the stories of Jesus directly." Now, Lane, given you've been studying religion for over 60 years now, why do you finally feel ready? I mean, you know so much, you've read so much, you've done so much.
Well, the thing is this, Ken, when I got interested, it wasn't about Jesus so much. What do we know about Jesus? And what we know about Jesus is all constructed, 40 or 50 or 60 or 100 years later. So I was looking at how the Christian movement started, and that really took me into the second century. So I was focused on that. And also, then the secret gospel suddenly landed on our heads as this massive, great treasure trove of sacred texts that we didn't know anything about. That captivated me completely. So most of my energy and excitement was focused on the secret gospels, how they were rejected, how these were chosen, how the whole movement got constructed. So I wasn't looking at Jesus so much, but at the formation of Christianity, which is a bit later period. This time, though, I've been teaching about how Christianity began, and you have to start with the Gospels in the New Testament, because or in the letters of Paul, which are the earliest writings we have. So I've been teaching about them, but I had never addressed them because I thought, who needs another book about Jesus? I mean, there's just only a several billion, probably.
Well, I'm glad you wrote this one. And I love your technique. What I noticed in the book and really appreciated was you often start with a question or questions and then you explore possible answers. It's similar to the scientific method familiar to your biology professor, Dad, and even your late husband, Heinz Pagels, who was a professor of physics. In the introduction, for example, you write, "I cannot resist asking not only who was Jesus, but also who is he? How did the rabbi known as Jesus of Nazareth come to be pictured as the Son of God, enthroned in heaven next to the Lord of hosts?" And because of those questions, the book reads to me not only as a scientific inquiry, but as something of a mystery with you as the detective.
Well, I've always felt this was detective work, because
Yes.
when we found those other gospels, which my favorite professors used to say, we thought they were just weird. He was the Archbishop of Sweden, actually. So he was a serious Lutheran. And he said, you have to be very careful. This stuff is heresy. And we didn't know what we were getting into. So that was utterly fascinating. And yes, it felt like a detective story. But then looking at who Jesus was, that is, what do we know about him and what don't we know, which is most of it, is a detective story because there are obviously anecdotes about a real person, and then there are things added to it. And somebody whose legend grows too. So things get added and things get thrown in there from the tradition that was his tradition, which was Jewish tradition. So finding out what happened, or so far as we can tell, which is limited, is a matter of piecing things together.
I think at least the one question that you can answer was that you do answer with certainty in the book was Jesus a real person? And the answer is yes.
Yes, I have no doubt about that because, some people thought, well, here's somebody who has a miraculous birth and he dies and he's raised again and he sounds like one of the gods, stories about Hercules or Superman or somebody like that. But when you have, so you can't tell so much from the writings of people who were his followers. But when you look at people who couldn't stand him, like Senator Tacitus, who thought people were crazy, this cult about a crucified Jew,
Yes, it does sound crazy.
and others, I mean Josephus, who was a educated historian and wrote
The
about
Jewish
the
Wars.
war and wrote a lot more. And Philo of Alexandria, who's another prolific writer, also contemporary of Jesus, they all knew that there was a man, Jesus of Nazareth, who was called the Messiah and who was crucified by Pilate. So I thought, mythical people don't have real enemies or a death date, an execution date. This is very specific. And it's targeting somebody that about which there are no neutral sources. People either love him or they can't stand him. And that sounds very real. There's a charismatic and powerful person
I never thought of
on
that.
earth.
Only a real person would have enemies.
Well, no, I mean, if you're Batman, you can have fictional
Oh,
enemies,
a
right?
fictional
Or
item like the
Superman,
Joker, yeah.
but you don't have
Right.
real human enemies, not,
Now, of course, a primary question, perhaps the most primary when examining the historical mystery of Jesus, is why he became the focus of a new religion.
Yes.
A religion over 2,000 years old now, the most popular in the world. We can ask the same thing, I guess, about Buddha and Muhammad, to a lesser extent, maybe Joseph Smith, L. Ron Hubbard, and before we turned on the mics, Rabbi Menachem Schneerson with the Chabad movement. And in the book, you give several reasons, but perhaps most of all is the power of story.
Yes, I mean, the power of story and the fact that this is really about a human being, it's not a myth. It follows a pattern. I only realized this when I was finished, that the Passover story, for example, starts with people brutally dominated by foreign powers, right? And then the Lord delivers them and they have their own land and they become a great empire and a great people. Or Daniel in the lion's den comes out unscathed. People who are suffering are rescued. And Jesus of Nazareth, who's abandoned and accused of in, unjustly of a capital crime and horrible torture and dies horribly, comes back. So what I felt is that all of them start in the world that we live in, which has war and injustice and suffering and death and illness of all kinds. And but they always move into kind of hope. Something opens up. And in even Jesus of Nazareth, who dies a horrible death, they say, well, yes, but he came back and he's with us.
And that's very attractive to the people who read that and know the stories.
And especially, I was thinking, if you look at the Greek gods, Ken, and you just say, who do they look like, right? They look like the emperor and the court. They dress well, they eat well, they're very powerful. But if you look at Jesus of Nazareth, he's a very humble man. He's I think perhaps not literate, although he apparently memorized a great deal of the scriptures, which he would have learned as a boy. But the story turns out very terribly. And yet, and there's a lot of humility in it. And then people say, yes, but God is with us in this man. And if God is with him, he could be with anyone in any circumstance, because it really doesn't get worse than what happened to him.
And that power of story, I noticed in your own personal experience. So, in the Why Religion book, you talk about how, as a child, that also was something you were fascinated by. Like you mentioned The Wizard of Oz and Robin Hood and the Men in the Sherwood Forest.
Well, yes, it's not just any story. It's a story that can become a template of your life. I don't know what story you would have identified with at that point, but for me, it
My
was
wife thinks it's Harold and the Purple Crayon, a children's book, because I tend to go off in all directions, but eventually something productive comes out of it.
Well, that's great. For me, it was Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz, a little dog going out and killing the Wicked Witch,
Yes.
Blend of the good, and then finds out that the wizard is a fraud and she gets back home. I mean, it's a great story. And I was living it when I was 7 or 8, And when I encountered the stories of Jesus through the charismatic preaching of Graham, it's like this is not just a story, it's not just entertainment. It's a paradigm for your life. It says, well, there's good and evil in the world and they're contesting, and you can be part of this great drama. You stand on the side of God against evil and death and darkness, and you can participate in this story. And it makes the people who do feel empowered, among other things.
And maybe that quest for social justice, which you felt as a child you were missing in the Methodist Church in Palo Alto.
Yes, I mean the stories of Jesus are, I think, very powerful because he extended the kind of compassion and sense of responsibility to other people that is part of Jewish tradition. He extended it not just to his own people, but to Samaritan, to woman, to slaves. I mean,
Yes, to the poor, to lepers.
yes, and radically. See, because many people would not deal with those kinds of people who were really, the worst kind of underclass.
Now, the chapters in the book examine questions about Jesus, the historical and the mythological. For example, you have the virgin birth, what happened? The crucifixion, what could it mean? And resurrection, what did people say happened and what can be known? And as you do in the book, Elaine, I'd like to start with the virgin birth, which you call, quote, perhaps the most unusual of the gospel stories. What do you mean by unusual? Like the least credible, the hardest to believe?
Yes, because I mean, there are stories, in antiquity about great men having a genealogy that includes a god,
Like
like
Hercules.
Julius Caesar had Venus in his genealogy, and Plato's mother was said to have had a pregnancy that was infiltrated by a divine spirit as well. And Alexander the Great, I mean, that's something that's said, but they don't suggest that these women were virgins. I mean, it wasn't that it excluded sexuality. So I don't know of any other story quite like this one, even though there are special divine births. The Buddha has one too. But this is a really radical one. And of course, the chief clue is that the earliest story, which is Mark's, has no birth story. So only two out of four gospels now in the New Testament mention anything about a birth story.
Matthew and Luke.
Yeah. But Mark was the template that they both used, and they had to tack on something at the beginning because both Mark's story starts when Jesus is a young man. He's baptized by John the Baptist. And he receives a divine mission. The Spirit of God comes on him, right? He goes out in the wilderness. And John's gospel just says, where does he come from? He comes from God. That's all you need to know. But Matthew and Luke make up a story, each make up a story.
Now, the fact that it's so unusual, I also read in a recent New Yorker, there was a piece by Adam Gopnik on the book. And there was one line of his that really stood out, especially in light of the virgin birth and what you call this unusual story. He wrote, "People seek faith, and faith, by its nature, demands the embrace of what reason resists."
Well, that's interesting. I mean, yeah, I don't know. I think maybe in spite of that, I mean, I don't think Menachem Schneer said, well, maybe so.
Well, it seems almost a test of faith, maybe not a cause of it. The more difficult it is to believe, the more faith and belief you have to have, I guess.
Well, when you look at the birth stories, one Matthew creates about Jesus from a Davidic family living in Jerusalem with his parents, and people come from all over the world to celebrate his birth, and King Herod gets jealous because he hears that a young prince has been born who might supplant him. That's all a story of an imperial court, and you get these paintings, medieval times, of Jesus as a little prince holding an orb of the world and blessing people. He's a miniature prince. And then you get Luke's story about this is a couple from Nazareth. they're so poor that they can't find a place to stay, and they have to take shelter in a barn when the woman has her child and so forth. And they're very elaborate stories about lots of miracles. And you think, why are they doing this? And they both say Joseph was not the father of Jesus biologically. He both claim that Joseph was from the Davidic tribe, and that he could legitimate Jesus by adopting him, in effect. But neither one claims that he was the actual birth father of Jesus. And you think, why are they telling you this? Something about the birth is irregular. And then when you go into the stories that the New Testament tells, then you begin to understand that there's something there.
Well, you also talk, again, something I had never read before, but the virgin birth was something of a cover-up. If Joseph wasn't the father, who was? And it might have been illegitimate. And you write that there's some historical accounts it could be the result of a Roman soldier who raped Mary. You even provide accounts of a likely suspect named Panthera. So there's some historical evidence for this theory. It's not easily dismissed.
Well, that could be total slander on the part of people who despise the followers of Jesus. And we know that was something said by critics at least 60 or 70 years after his death. A lot of people were saying he was illegitimate and his father wasn't even Jewish. Now, that just could be an attack, But what was telling to me is that in the story of Mark, the first account, Jesus is called the son of Mary. And you wouldn't call a child the son of Mary if he had an acknowledged father, even if the father were had died. And both stories say Joseph realized that Mary was pregnant and it was not his child. And both of them refer to what happens, what Deuteronomy says a man should do if he finds that his fiancée is pregnant and it's not his child. He should privately break the marriage contract unless she's complicit and has been unfaithful to him, in which case she should be put to death along with her lover. But if she was forced, then she's not responsible and you just sort of don't shame her, but you also don't marry her. And that's what Matthew says Joseph decided to do until an angel intervened. So there's a lot of evidence in within the stories, not just the slander, that suggests something about it was very embarrassing for followers of Jesus.
Virgin birth, I think, is somewhat of a foundation of modern day Christianity, but whether to take it as fact or metaphor isn't clear. In the book, you quote a Catholic priest, Raymond Brown, who says the virgin birth is, quote, a theological statement, not a biological one. And I think by that he means it's a metaphor, one based in faith rather than fact. So we'll never know for sure, but it seems like this is a way of round it. It's not as important to take it literally.
I think that's true, but I also want to say that when I first thought about the claims that Jesus' birth was some very shameful thing, I thought it was slander, and I didn't want to go into it because it sounds sensationalistic. Somebody had written a book called The Illegitimacy of Jesus in 1981. The only woman scholar, Roman Catholic herself, wrote this, and I didn't read the book at the time because I thought, oh, come on, that's she's just trying to get attention for her. I don't know. I didn't like the sound of it, and so I never read it. But recently, when I had to think about this, I did read it and realized that it's a likely hypothesis, although we don't know.
And chances are we never will. So I kind of appreciated Raymond Brown's, it's not really critical to the story or to your faith.
No, it isn't. But some people today really would feel that it is.
Now, given that it's Good Friday, let's go from the virgin birth to the crucifixion. You quote the historian S.G.F. Brandon, who says, ironic though it be, the most certain thing known about Jesus of Nazareth is that he was crucified by the Romans as a rebel against their government in Judea.
Yes.
Unquote. But how it came about is certainly much less certain. You wrote the book, and we talked about this be again before we sat down here, The Origin of Satan, on how Christians demonized the Jews and somewhat exonerated Pilate, the Roman governor of Judea, who had sole authority to order the crucifixion, any crucifixion. And this was especially evident in the Gospels of Matthew and Luke, this story, this demonization of the Jews, this blame, the Jews killed Christ.
Yes, I mean, it struck me as so counter-historical, counterfactual, because, as you said, nobody could order crucifixion except the governor. And he did it all the time. There were thousands of Jews who were crucified for insurrection against the government. The only other people who were subjected to this worst of all tortures were slaves who were disobedient to their masters. The Romans demanded obedience. And Jesus was not a revolutionary. So Pilate would have routinely ordered the arrest of somebody charged with that. That's what people who knew him politically and who were contemporaries of Jesus and Pilate say, reliable sources, people in political positions of power, they all agree that Pilate ordered this. But what I realized is, why don't they tell it that way? But before any of these stories of Jesus are written, the ones in the New Testament Gospels, those are all written after the Jewish War or at the end of the Jewish War. Some people think 68 to 70. They were writing, followers of Jesus were writing about him. More likely, they're writing after the war. And what had happened before Mark writes, the earliest writer, is that followers of Jesus were being hunted down. His relatives had been hailed into court and accused of being revolutionaries in on the plot of Jesus of Nazareth. If he was a seditionist, you probably are too. That was guilt by association, but that's how it works, especially if you don't need a lot of evidence. Somebody says you're one of those revolutionaries, you probably are. And you can deny it, but they know. And so the three most famous leaders of Jesus, group followers after his death, were all brutally killed before the Gospels were written. Paul was crucified, I'm sorry, Paul was beheaded, whipped and beheaded by order of Roman magistrate. Presumably the charge there is insurrection against Rome. Peter, his closest follower, was crucified also on the same charge. And his brother James, who was the leader of the group in Jerusalem, was lynched in Jerusalem. So, right before the Gospels were written, his followers were on notice that if you're recognized as a follower of Jesus of Nazareth, don't get caught because they're going to kill you. And so the followers who wrote about him were trying to say two things. One, he wasn't a seditionist. He wasn't an insurrectionist. He wasn't militant. There were a lot of militants, religious militants, and they started a war against Rome, which ended in the terrible destruction of Jerusalem
The temple, 66 AD, right?
and the complete desolation of the holy city completely. It was left as a pile of rubble, practically, a beautiful city. And second, they wanted to say, and we're not revolutionaries either. So, well, then how could he be crucified? That doesn't make any sense. Of course he was one of those guys. And they said, no, how could it happen? Well, the only other way they could make sense out of it and tell a story is, well, Pilate thought he was innocent, but some of the chief authorities in the temple turned him over to Pilate because he was creating demonstrations. That's in the Gospel of John. And took it to the council and said, this man is causing trouble. And if this happens, public disturbances, when Passover happens in Jerusalem, the Romans are going to come in here with force and they're going to destroy our people, which is what happened. And so they were rightly worried, and it was their job to keep the peace. So they handed him over to Pilate and said, this man is dangerous. We have to get rid of him. Because it was better to do that than put the people themselves at risk. But in the process, they have to say, well, how could they do that? Because Pilate's the only one who could give the order. Well, they end up shouting so loud that he's this poor, weak guy. He just can't stand crowds rioting. And he said, oh, just go ahead and do it. But that couldn't have happened. But that's the story that they tell. And what's also very telling is if that you look at the stories, one written probably around the year 70 mark, Matthew and Luke written 10 to 15 years later, or 20, John's Gospel written 25 or 30, Pilate gets nicer and nicer and sympathetic, and the Jews get worse and worse. And that's as animosity between followers of Jesus and Jews who think that he's a complete heretic, and his followers too, are more intensely contending against each other after the Jewish War and blaming people like insurrectionists who brought catastrophe on the whole people. So it's a much more complicated story than the one in the New Testament, but that's the story that Christians have believed. And that's the story that has gone through centuries, millennia, so that even now, if a student comes into my class, Jewish students or Christian students, they know that the Jews killed Jesus. That's what they think. Because I asked one student last year, oh, you were in my class. What surprised you? And I knew that his relatives, it was a very Orthodox family, he said that the Jews didn't kill Jesus. And I said, did you believe that? And he said, well, yeah, I've heard that my whole life. And so it's a story with a terrible legacy. Only after Christians were not the target from the Romans anymore in the 4th century, when they became powerful and they became allies of the government, then being Jewish and converting people to Judaism became a capital crime in the 4th century. In the Holy Roman Empire, so-called.
And it was really, really just scapegoating the Jews. You're kind of to save your own life as Christians. We have no beef with the Romans. You guys are okay. It was the Jews that killed Christ, and that was the story. Elaine, there was. I don't know if you know the comedian Sarah Silverman.
Yes, of course.
She has a joke about the crucifixion and the Jews. To me, it kind of sums it up. She says everyone blames the Jews for killing Christ, and the Jews try to pass it off on the Romans. I'm one of the few people who believe it was the blacks.
Well,
So,
that's how it works, right? I
right,
mean,
one oppressed group says, no, it's not us, the guys below us.
that's the trouble. I mean, unfortunately, that's become a legend, and the Christian Empire, as it became, really targeted Jews as other, and it really didn't happen that much until the 4th century. My colleague at Berkeley, Daniel Boyarin, has shown this quite clearly, and we're much more aware of it than we were.
Now, before you had talked also about you had mentioned that the critics about the crucifixion, the most damning evidence against the Messiah, his crucifixion, they transformed it into evidence. Well, not the critics. They were saying, why worship somebody who was crucified, a crucified Jew? And it was actually transformed into evidence of his divine mission. So it was like spinning the story in such a way that it worked out. And ironically, you cite Viktor Frankl. Jews survived Auschwitz. And you wrote, Frankl recognized finding meaning as an essential human need. Well, what's the connection between how they took this terrible event that made it seem ridiculous that anybody would worship Jesus, who was killed and crucified and Jewish, and then all of a sudden he's, this son of God?
After his death, I mean, his death was a tremendous shock to his followers and very traumatic. They wrote about it in excruciating ways. And they had to find some meaning in it. Or either that or they quit the movement. Many of them quit the movement. He's not the Messiah. It couldn't be. This wouldn't happen if he were the Messiah. God would have saved him. But Others, Paul was the first who said, well, you know, what could it mean? He said, Christ, our Passover, was sacrificed for us. He's the Passover lamb. And the Passover lamb, you know, the blood is put on the door lintels so that the firstborn of God's people are spared. And I just got an email from the author of this book, the Rebbe, about Zalman Schachter, saying there's an ancient belief that the death of a righteous person, a tzaddik, can redeem the sins of others. I didn't know that, but that's what he says. And so Paul said, yes, he's the sacrificial lamb.
He died for our sins.
And you know, we eat the Passover lamb, and there's the story about the last Passover Jesus celebrated with his followers. He told them to eat himself, right? Eat my blood, drink my blood. It's very strange. And John's gospel actually pictures Jesus as the Passover lamb. So that's how they tell the story. That's how they find meaning in it. And John's gospel is very radical because it says, why did he die on the cross? He came into the world for one purpose. His purpose was to be the Lamb of God, the sacrifice for sin. The other gospels don't say it that explicitly. But John pounds that home and he says, well, this isn't an accident. This is not a terrible turn of events. This is part of a divine plan. And then they have the idea that there are two messiahs, so that, and this is also a belief among the people of the Dead Sea Scrolls, particularly devout sect of Jews who interpreted the scriptures, probably influenced John the Baptist and Jesus, spoke about atonement in that way. So it's very strange, but that's the way the story was told. So that it's not a catastrophe, as they tell it, as John tells it. It's a triumph. And at his last breath in John's gospel, he says, it's accomplished. What I came to do, the mission is accomplished.
And of course, that crucifixion is followed a few days later by the resurrection. And you write, you have a whole chapter on that, Elaine. You write that historical evidence can neither prove nor disprove Jesus's resurrection. But there are historical accounts of people claiming to see Jesus after he died, which you've researched. And you quote an historian, Dale Allison, who calls it the primary puzzle of New Testament research. Is that a puzzle that can ever be solved? Is that all speculation?
There are a few people who think they can prove that Jesus rose from the dead historically. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. All we know historically is that somehow some of his followers were seized with the conviction that he was alive, that he was with them. They felt he spoke to them. Some said they saw him. Now, you know that many people do see those who die after they die. They don't come out of the grave, which is the story in the Gospels. But as Paul said, people have sometimes a sense that they hear the voice of someone who has died, or they have the sense of the presence of that person. And apparently, many people had that experience with this very charismatic rabbi.
And you've had your own experience with that, haven't you, Elaine? You wrote that you used to, and I'm quoting, unthinkingly accept the rational assumption that visions of life after death were projection or delusion.
Yes.
But that changed. You yourself had experiences you can't explain, sensing the presence of people who had died. And you write, these were not mediated by ordinary vision or hearing, but by some other mode of perception, one that I found inexplicable, yet it felt more real than real. And I think those have to do with your late son Mark, who died at 6 and a half, and then your husband Heinz, who died just about 6 months later.
Yeah, I mean, I was a rationalist. That's how I was brought up. And so I thought, you know, somebody dies, that's they just disintegrate. But So I was surprised to have experiences that didn't feel just like psychological compensation, which some people assume it is when they talk about that, which it might be. They did seem actually surprising and for some, in some strange way, very real. And I've talked to many other people who've had such experiences.
I have too.
Have you?
I think if you have that personal experience, it's hard to just dismiss it.
Yes, it is. And it's in many cultures. And so anyway, I don't think it's just projection or fantasy or wish fulfillment, which is what I would have assumed if someone else had said it. Because sometimes you hear people say things that you would never say, or just it just sounds like that person. So who knows? That is what ignited the movement, the sense that Jesus was not defeated. And there's many stories about, I touched him, or I just heard his voice, or there's this light, all kinds of stories. But that conviction is what ignited the movement.
Right, so these differing accounts, and whether it's a physical body of Jesus or a spiritual body, and I know there's been a lot of debate on that, there's no mistaking, as you say, the story's influence. You're right, the Christian movement became powerful because Christians could claim to offer eternal life, potentially to everyone, no matter who they are, poor people, former criminals, women who were oppressed at the time. Which taps into our innate fear, I think, of death and desire for an afterlife, a life better than the one we have here on earth. It's seen as a victory over death, which can be a great comfort. So, in effect, it seems almost the resurrection itself is more attractive than Jesus' teachings.
Well, it depends who you are. I mean, I always felt the teachings are very important, the way that, as we said before, that the universalism of it, I mean, that's at least what we hear in the New Testament, that he reached out to everyone, not just the people that most rabbis would speak with, to women or to slaves or to outsiders, Gentiles. But also, there's this sense of spiritual power available in the movement. His followers, he told them to heal people in his name. He apparently taught them techniques, told them to use his name. And his name was used by magicians in Egypt for centuries, and also many other names of God in Hebrew or garbled Hebrew. You find them in the magical texts of Egypt, because it was thought to be a power name. So that's the conviction that comes out of this strange tradition. And then, Ken, I wanted to figure out, why do people today still find those stories engaging?
Right, yeah, 2,000 years of that.
And that's why I put that part in about people converting today, or filmmakers or artists.
Oh, yeah, I wanted to ask a question about that because that's in the last chapter. You talk about artists and filmmakers and their depictions of Jesus today. And there's one thing I learned about you. You include Martin Scorsese's film, The Last Temptation of Christ, which came out in 1988. And you say in the book that he read your book, The Gnostic Gospels, loved it, certainly entranced by it, and met with you before making the film. I was wondering, what did you talk about and what did you think of his depiction of Jesus, a very human Jesus, in the movie?
Well, that was before the film. He was actually making Raging Bull at the time. It was a long time ago,
Oh.
because he showed me some of it. He has a theater in his apartment.
Well, what an
And
honor.
it was wonderful. He'd read the Gnostic Gospels. He grew up Catholic, in the Lower East Side of New York, and he was going to be a priest. He said he was saved from that by the movies.
Ah, I love that line. Yeah, that's in the movie Save Me from the Priesthood.
It did. But he thought his father-in-law was Roberto Rossellini, Isabella Rossellini, his then wife's father. And Roberto Rossellini had done a film about Jesus for Italian television. But it was very conventionally Catholic, very sort of pietistic in a way. It's very hard to get away from that if you are Italian and you live with that Italian art,
Right.
Whoa. I mean, it wasn't bad, it just wasn't very engaging. So he wanted to do something that was. And he talked at the time about a Roman senator whose son decides to become a Christian and horrifies his father because, you can get killed for that. And so this was what he had in mind. But he didn't follow that because he didn't have a script. So then he went to Kazantzakis' novel because Kazantzakis had a vision which spoke deeply to Scorsese's vision of Catholic Christianity, how the spirit and the flesh contend, the life of human pleasures and somehow a life of huge sacrifice. So he did that.
And that was controversial, wasn't it, in the movie? Some, I think, very religious Christians
Oh,
said,
yeah.
no, that's not Jesus.
Yes. But that was one way somebody in the 21st century did it. And then I was interested in two others. One is by a British actor, Mark Dornford Smith, who has now become a citizen of South Africa. And he pictured Jesus in his film called Son of Man, 2005, beautiful film, as in Africa, as an African, fighting against an African brutal dictatorship. He didn't put white people in the film because he didn't want to racialize it. But it was a man fighting against a brutal government, ruthless government. And he was fighting on the side of right against brutality. And he gets killed for it. And then he pictures the death of Jesus. It's in the film, Jesus is after he's dead, is lying across his mother's lap, very much in the position that you see the Michelangelo,
The Pieta.
the Pietà by Michelangelo in the Vatican. But it's also patterned on the death of Steve Biko, who was one of the great heroes of the apartheid movement, who was killed horribly by the government forces. So he puts the story into a 21st century context. And it what strikes me is that the story works that way. It can work that way. And the third one that I chose was a beautiful film, I think, by a British screenwriter, a woman who read a lot of the history. And it's about Mary Magdalene. And it's she also uses not just the Mary Magdalene of the New Testament, but also of the secret gospels as somebody who really understands Jesus. It's the only picture I know of Mary Magdalene that doesn't sexualize her either as the wife and lover of Jesus
Or the prostitute.
or a prostitute, which the other two films do, because that's become so much part of the story. She does, in fact, picture Mary Magdalene as a woman with a deep spiritual search who is drawn to Jesus because of the depth of his teaching and who witnesses to that. It's a beautiful film.
Now, in that Adam Gopnik piece in The New Yorker, he calls the new book Miracles and Wonder kind of a culmination of your life's work and studies. I hope it doesn't mean it's the last. In the book's introduction, you invite the reader to share in the adventure. Do you already have an idea for the next book? Any other adventures you'd like to take the reader on?
I don't yet, I mean, it's so absorbing when you're working on a book. When I wrote Why Religion, I thought, okay, that's it. I mean, a memoir is not something I've ever written before, and I probably won't do it again. But I didn't plan to write another book. But when I decided that I've been teaching for a long time and I love it, but doing it at this pace is just not something I want to spend the next, 20 years doing.
Right.
So, I don't know. There may be another book, but I have no idea yet what
Well, I
happens.
hope there's another. I think it will just come to you.
Who knows? That might be fun.
Now, I have one last question. At the end of Miracles and Wonder, You write the stories of Jesus, whether historically accurate or not, quote, give what we most often need, an outburst of hope. And at the end of
Yes.
Why Religion, the memoir, you write, however it happens, sometimes hearts do heal through what I can only call grace. Now, grace and that outburst of hope are important parts, I think, of the religious experience, but they can also be found in what you had growing up in Palo Alto, a passion for the arts, dance, music, literature, and for Martin Scorsese, the movies that saved him from the priesthood. But religion, certainly Christianity, has its own arts, its own music, poetry, the literature of the Old and New Testament, and the secret teachings. Do you find that religion and art serve the same purpose in that respect? Life-affirming or...
Absolutely. I mean, I happen to love the poetry of Dylan Thomas, Catholic, who says, "And death shall have no dominion." And he's writing about London being bombed by the Nazis, you know, and he says, "No, death is not going to win." And that's the kind of conviction. I mean, I love the depictions of art. That's why in the book I have, you know, 16 pages of illustrations of very different ways that people picture Jesus and use the story because it works for them. And that's what interests me, is the experience, the multiple ways people relate to these stories. It's not just an old folktale at all. It's a story that speaks to meaning in people's lives in a way that's in so many different ways.
Now, Elaine, I got to say, it was I'm so grateful for talking with us today. It was an honor for me because I've followed your work and loved it for so many years. I'd like to leave with something you wrote in the last chapter of Miracles and Wonder, and you were talking about people like Jimmy and Rosalind Carter, Martin Luther King, Desmond Tutu, Pope Francis. You wrote, all of these recognize that Jesus's teaching was radical then as it is now. I'm especially moved by those who recall the themes that Luke says Jesus first preached in Nazareth, quoting words of the prophet Isaiah, who said, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor, to proclaim release to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." And as you say, a message, sadly, as radical as ever.
Yes, and as much needed.
Yes, very much so.
Thank you for bringing that into it. That was wonderful.
Oh, thank you, Elaine. Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KBOO Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, we'd just like to hear it all again. You can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, Jonesy, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Elaine Pagels, author of the new book, Miracles and Wonder, The Historical Mystery of Jesus from Doubleday. You can learn more about Elaine and her work online at elaine-pagels.com. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, May 8th, which just happens to be Thomas Pynchon's 88th birthday. Pynchon's first novel in 12 years, Shadow Ticket, is due out in October. Tom, if you're listening, you're always welcome on the show. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying, hope to see you all again then.